The entire government just decided to ban the therapy centers to cure homosexuality for minors and to not include that type of care into the healthcare program refunds. So I'm with Mrs. Françoise Jusset, and you are a psychologist and part of the Institute for Sexual Minority Health. Hi.
Hi.
So I imagine that you're quite satisfied with that decision. Do you think it's enough? Do you think that this movement to claim to be able to cure LGBT individuals will stop with that type of decisions?
Well, it certainly will help to make it explicit. I think we need to draw some important distinctions. Homosexuality has been depathologized since the 1970s. As soon as something is no longer considered an illness, then the idea of curing it and of trying to find remedies for it becomes problematic. So the reason why this bill was introduced was to deal much more with the issue of transgender kids. But also because in Ontario specifically, there is a program that's very well known and recognized in Toronto where the mental health personnel believe that acting on a child's gender expression, because really that's what we're talking about here. We're saying, well, you know, little boys should be forced to play with trucks and little girls with dolls. I'm simplifying, but if you really look at what it's about, it's really trying to get children to conform to gender norms with the hope that somehow it's going to have an impact on a child's gender identity development. Or, and I think that's not been stated as explicitly, but it certainly was historically stated as the hope that it would cure, and I'm putting that in quotes, what was called a pre-homosexual condition. So there's a lot of assumptions that are made by this this team that somehow impacting in whatever way the way a child plays, whom the child plays with, what their interests are, will make a difference in terms of their gender identity or their sexual orientation development. Now, the sexual orientation piece has been really kind of set aside in the last few years, but it was there historically in the statement of purpose of the associated with these types of interventions. And, the problem is that what never gets measured or never gets assessed, if you will, is the very destructive impact of forcing children into stereotypical gender roles. Mm. And you know, because a child is a child, they will, for the most part, attempt to comply with what significant adults around them are asking of them. But just because a child plays with one toy versus another toy doesn't mean that anything has changed inside in terms of the goals that that these types of programs or these types of therapists will claim they're working towards. And in fact, we do have some evidence that that children will instead internalize a sense of shame about who they are, right? So the message is, okay, I shouldn't play with these toys, I shouldn't play with these girls or these boys, I should play with people of my own gender, et cetera, et cetera, and I'll do it, but that means that I'm doing something bad if I do what I really feel comes naturally. So this is the other huge problem, is that it actually creates what we call in my profession iatrogenic effects, i.e. that the person actually, the therapy actually makes people sick. It actually creates problems instead of solving them.
Yeah, but
the other significant problem with this approach is that there is absolutely no critical perspective on what it means to be a quote-unquote real boy, real girl,
yeah.
Right? So the idea somehow that there are, it plays into this phenomenon of polarization of the genders, of an extreme binary vision of boyhood and girlhood, and of course not allowing for any kind of diversity in between, that goes without saying. But it doesn't at all have a critical view of, you know, why is it that a truck is a boy's toy and not a girl's toy. And we're really in the middle of a very very alarming social phenomenon where the polarization between the world of girls and the world of boys is ever growing and ever amplified by society. Whether it's, you know, studies about differences between male brains and female brains, which is a field okay. that has been actually criticized, and many researchers have talked about the methodological flaws with the argument that somehow there's some major differences between male and female brains, that it's actually called neurosexism, and it's interesting. So, I mean, we're witnessing this period in time which actually is more conservative in terms of male-female roles, boy-girl roles, than in the 1970s and 80s, which is quite ironic and really should lead us to thinking about what that means and what it means to us as a society. And instead, what we're saying is we're going to take these children and we're going to box them into these very, very narrow gender roles. Now, I'm going to add something. I know some of the people who are doing this work because we see each other at conferences, et cetera, WPATH, et cetera. And I will choose to believe that there may actually be misguided goodwill behind this effort. And what I mean by that is that the argument that's often advanced is, but we have to help these children because if they show up in school, And children, by children we mean largely children assigned male at birth, right? So we're talking mm. about, because gender norms are so much more restrictive for kids who mm. are assumed to be boys at birth, what we're talking about here is really about professionals saying, well, we need to make sure they adhere to gender norms by the time they get to school, otherwise what's going to happen to them? We all know what's going to happen to them.
Yeah.
We know the kind of bullying, the merciless bullying that they'll be subjected to. However, one has to question if the solution to this bullying is to actually affect change in the child. These children are often extremely creative children. They love to dance and sing and draw, and they're incredibly expressive. And what we're doing is we're actually suppressing and oppressing that natural creativity in the name of really an issue that really has to be dealt with in the schools, which is the whole segregation of the boy-girl world and the rampant misogynistic, sexist kind of language that is allowed to take place between boys and girls from a very young age, and which feeds this idea that somehow boys cannot love to dance and wear pretty things okay. and like sparkly shoes, and that, you know, girls, however, are given a break. They can have all sorts of interests in childhood. Usually, it hits at puberty. At puberty, girls or children assigned girl at birth are expected to toe the line, to get into makeup and shopping and boys, of course, et cetera, et cetera. But so they get, I would put in quotations, but a break, usually until puberty. But for children assigned boy or male at birth, that oppression begins at a very, very young age. So the whole thing about conversion, or what's also called reparative therapy, really has to be looked at in a much broader social, critical way, and really with absolutely no research confirming that restricting a child's expression will do anything, even if it were desirable as an outcome to affect gender identity or sexual orientation, even if it were, that restricting gender expression has anything to do with the development of their gender identity or sexual orientation. That has not scientifically been demonstrated. And so I'm not sure on what basis we are acting on these children. And if the only reason is to deal with the parents' terror, and I mean terror. I just finished a doctorate degree and a research where I talked to these parents. That was my subject. And they are terrified, and they should be. They should be, because what we know is that these kids really, really do get targeted, much more so than the others. However, what was interesting in my research is the parents recognized instinctively that the best protective factor for these kids was acceptance and not rejection of who they were. That if we accept them, and if they're accepted in the home, if they're accepted by the parents, it gives them the inner strength, if there is bullying, if there are nasty comments, for them to be actually able to protect themselves. So really, what we're saying here is that what professionals should be doing with these parents is saying, okay, let's talk about how you can make your kids stronger, and then let's also make you stronger so you can go to the school and say, in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, what are you doing to break down these gender divides that are so hurtful, not just to my child who likes things that are not considered right here and right now typical for his gender or her gender, but what are you doing beyond that to support all the children? Because my contention is this, we're not just dealing with the kids that are that we think might be trans or gay or lesbian or whatever, or queer. We're dealing also with all the children affected by this oppression. They all feel it. So even the captain of the hockey team, the boy who's captain of the hockey team, might like to join the choir, or he might like to get into floral arrangements or drawing. What are the chances that he's going to let himself go towards those interests in the current climate in our schools? Yeah. And by the way, the schools are considered the most dangerous place for these children. Every parent, every child will identify the school as the most dangerous location, home as the safest, in families, of course, where these kids are supported to express who they are.
So we see that there is like some very intense debates between scientists and people that work on that issue, but at the same time, these therapy centers are not forbidden and can be forbidden for adults. But what's how to change the parents' mentalities of the young people that have that present non-heterosexual behavior or attract for not their first their first gender representation? What has to be done with the parents?
The parents need a lot of support, and the problem is that the parents, many of them, turn to the professionals. And I think this is where our responsibility is. You said something interesting. You said there's a disagreement between scientists and practitioners. I disagree with you. There's much science to support what I'm saying,
that these
interventions are harmful to the children as well as adults, as well as teens.
But
within the field, there's the research coming out of that institution, out of CAMH, but there's a lot of research that is coming out that contradicts what CAMH is producing and also criticizes serious methodological problems with their research.
Yeah, but you understand that people that represent these sides are also presenting with some maybe not confirmed scientific reasons and scientific opinions that can be that can attract some parents. So, do you think that this duality?
Yeah, I think it's going to attract the parents often that are most afraid and that are most lost, most confused. I think that what to say to parents is there's nothing wrong with your child. Your child is expressing gender in an expressive and natural way that really needs to be allowed. Now, I think that all parents make decisions about how, when, where their child will be able to express certain aspects of their interests because they're watchful. They don't want the child to be the target. So I think that you know, there's a psychologist colleague of mine who's written a book called Gender Born, Gender Made, Diane Arensaft, and she talks about parents walking the quote-unquote gender tightrope. And I think parents at every moment are evaluating what's best for the child. However, what I encourage parents to do is to breathe deeply, to approach the school, but also to talk to their child. I've seen children as young as 5 or 6 make their own decisions when they're given the proper information. So when they're told, you know, you really love those sparkly pink shoes, and they are quite beautiful. And just so you know, there's a kind of a silly world out there that actually thinks that little boys shouldn't be wearing sparkly pink slippers. But you know what? And they might make some nasty comments or some mean comments or some inconsiderate comments. So let's talk about how you'll respond to that. And let's talk about whether you decide to go out there or not. I much, much prefer when the child is the one making the decision about going out in the world with the pretty pink sparkly slippers or shoes than the parents or anybody else. And what's interesting is that the children can be taught to do that, but then it comes from them. It doesn't come from the outside. And the message needs to be made very clear to children that it's the silly, silly world out there. And really, I'm talking about developing this kind of critical view of social norms for men and women, girls and boys, from a very, very young age, so that the kids have less chance of internalizing the very negative messages that are sent to them, the looks, the comments, etc. So, and they go, oh, that's that silly, silly world that mom and dad, or mom and mom, or dad and dad, or whatever, were talking to me about. So I think that's really important to say to parents, is as much as possible, let your child decide. And when they come back from school, when they decided that day they were going to wear the pretty pink sparkly slippers, ask them how it went. Let's talk about it. But do the work also with the school. And I have to tell you, the schools are terrified of parents. So, you know, whenever I do this kind of work in school, I'm not talking about transgender or gender or sexual orientation issues in schools here. We're not even there. We're not talking about sexuality, homosexuality, trans issues, etc. We're just talking about boy-girl gender norms. And in 2015, it really absolutely amazes me and alarms me to say that it is still subversive. It is subversive in 2015 just to talk about gender norms and gender roles
in
the school.
That was my next question. Do you think there is enough done, or what would you do? What would you do better in terms of integration and acceptation, and also like talking of young sexual minorities and gender issues in schools all over Canada?
You know what? If you ask me honestly, I've distilled this down. Let's talk about gender norms. Let's talk about gender expression. Let's have that be the central discourse. That is the way that we leave no child behind. Because if we're talking about gender expression and gender norms, we should be able in 2015 to talk about that in school. And then we bring in all sorts of things related to that that have to do with sexual orientation and gender identity, etc. But the core issue is gender expression. And we cannot lose sight of that. What I wanted to say in terms of the schools, they are terrified of parents. This is the feedback I consistently get in the schools. But what will the parents say?
Yeah.
Right? And so the schools sometimes are afraid to put themselves in opposition to the parents. But I say to them, if you have a child who spews racism because their parents are teaching them this, are you going to stand by and just say, well, you know, we can't go against the parents' values? No.
Okay.
Your responsibility is to encourage and support and teach the values, the societal values that we've all agreed on in this country. And part of it, and it's protected, this is what oftentimes school boards and schools don't realize, they're protected. Their right is protected to speak openly about these subjects.
Of course.
And it's not just that they can, is that there is really an obligation to reflect society as it is lived outside of the school system. And if we start with the young children, if we can just let the little boy play with the doll And I'm simplifying, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And if we let the little girl be sporty and not be interested in makeup, et cetera, which, by the way, starts at 7 or 8 years old in the girls now.
So one also, my question is a reaction from you. How do you feel about that high school in Ontario, just on the concept that is strict only for LGBT teenagers?
Yeah.
How do you feel to that?
Well, how I feel about this is that, you know, the measure to which the measures taken by minority groups, whatever they may be, to create safe spaces is a measure of the lack of acceptance in the rest of society. So I often get the question about ghettoization. Is it ghettoizing to have gay villages? Is it ghettoizing to have schools for LGBT kids? Nobody wants a ghetto. Nobody wants isolation. But the isolation is absolutely necessary as long as what's happening in our schools is happening. We have a study coming out of the U.S., a journal called Pediatrics, which is the most read and significant pediatric journal, widely read and significant pediatric journal in the U.S. And the study came out 3 years ago saying that gender nonconforming children before the age of, if you're a gender nonconforming child before the age of 11, it predicts a greater chance of post-traumatic stress disorder, lifetime post-traumatic stress disorder.
You're coming to my next question. After that, because we see that situation today, there is not that acceptance. There is still some of those therapy centers that reflect something. And in the houses, I assume that a lot of parents are restraining that possibility of other gender. So what is the thing that has to be done for homosexual teenagers that are close to enter, for example, university or cégep, and that will face with a lot of other teenagers? How do we deal in terms of psychological support to these people? Because we see that it's also a very risky population in terms of suicides and post-traumatic disorder, as you said.
Right. Well, I think that parental support is important, but like you're saying, if it's not available, then I think that, you know, in Quebec, for example, you can access medical and psychological care as of age 14. So we absolutely have to have public services available for these kids. The problem is that in our province in Quebec, the public sector refuses to make psychologists, social workers, etc., available to be trained in being able to welcome these kids and these teenagers and to help them get to where they need to be in terms of the gender journeys. So, you know, that's a huge problem because kids can access, but there's nobody to access or hardly anybody, certainly not in the public system. So, so that's a big problem. And yes, we need to work on that.
That's the public powers that need to change that.
Yeah, absolutely. Clearly. So there's work that needs to be done to explain. But, you know, it's a public system that's already completely stretched to the limit. So, again, I don't think there's any ill will, but I think that there is a sense of, you know, we already have, what I was told is we already have a year and a half waiting list for, you know, general psychology or general kinds of issues. How are we going to take on yet another? So yes, but for trans folks, well, I mean, you'll see, you'll talk to if you talk to Head and Hands, you'll see what their waiting list is like. So, yes, there's a huge in Quebec, and it's not true in every province. Ontario has a different configuration of issues than we do in Quebec. Each province, in terms of transgender health, each province has its own configuration of challenges, of things that are more accessible, things that are less accessible. But there's an urgency to make services accessible, for sure.
This will be surely my last question. It's the tricky one, because we see, especially in the United States, that this therapy centers come usually from religious beliefs and especially Catholic opinions. Do you think that actually in Canada the religion is still a problem and is still acting against these issues of transgender and homosexuality acceptance in society?
Well, my sense of the of what we're talking about in Ontario, and you know, if I look at what the center we have here, I'm not I don't sense any kind of religious influence,
mm.
But I may be misinformed. Mm. You know, and I think we have to be careful when we talk about religions, because mm. there's such a diversity, right? There are mm. there are religious groups that are very open, very welcoming to sexual minority folks, and so we can't lump everything together.
Yeah,
and we can't also assume that the Christian churches are more open than other religious groups, because that's also not the case. Within
yeah.
every religion, there are more conservative and then much more open subgroups, if you will. But no, I think that there's... I think that there's a long-standing discomfort in the mental health professions and in the health professions around sexuality, and some very some people who are holding on to more maybe antiquated visions or versions mm. of human sexuality. So, you know, we do have a lot of research at this point that really should be taken into account by these centers and isn't necessarily.
Mm. So thank you, Mrs. Jussé, for this very, very interesting interview. So, yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.